Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast.
Hi everyone, and welcome once again to the Sports Pro Podcast. My name is Owen Connolly. I'm the editor at large at Sports Pro. Hope you're well. Joining me once again, Sports Pro digital editor Tom Bassam. Hi Tom.
Hi Owen.
And Sports Pro editorial director Michael Long. Hi Mike.
Hello Owen. Hi Tom.
Hello, Mike.
Well, that's that out of the way. We're going to be hearing in part two from Lee Price, who's the head of PR and mischief at bookmaker Paddy Power. We're going to be getting the Q&A section from his session, the last session of the Sports Pro Insider series of 2020, if you can believe that, which took place last week. He gave us a little presentation about some of their sponsorship activities. And then I led a Q&A with our audience, so we've got that to come. Before then, we have our final event, virtual event of 2020 altogether, which is the Sports Pro OTT Summit, which is going to be taking place on the 2nd and 3rd of December, next week as we're talking. And we are going to have a look ahead to that and just pick out a couple of the stories in the world of digital broadcasting that are just kind of percolating through the industry going into that conference. But before that, Tom, you have a new newsletter out. We have a new newsletter out. Sports Pro has a new newsletter out. But you are the author of the revamped Sports Pro OTT newsletter. What can you tell us about that?
As the face of the Sports Pro OTT newsletter, I can tell you that it replaces what was our previous OTT send out, which was a bunch of stories which we thought were interesting. But instead, we decided to kind of revamp it slightly. And rather than just kind of giving you those stories to read, giving them a little bit more context. So it's fortnightly. I'll be picking out a couple of trends that I find interesting, sharing those in abbreviated prose, and then also linking out to a few different other bits and pieces that I think are interesting to people working in the digital broadcast space. So the most recent one I hit on DAZN in Germany opting to launch its own linear channels, but also pointed to a couple of other bits of content that we've got going on, including your podcast last week, Owen, with Anouk Mertens.
Very good. There is a version of the newsletter, or there's a version of the copy anyway, on the Sports Pro website for anyone who wants to get a taste of what to expect. If you haven't already subscribed, then I guess that might be the thing that tips you over the edge, but really you should be subscribing already, shouldn't you? To kind of continue on that theme of stories to look out for, what has caught your eye? What should people be aware of, or what have you become aware of in the last few weeks that you think could have consequential impact further down the line in the broadcast space?
It's a story that when it came into the news meeting we have every morning, I was a little bit like, oh wow. I mean, it sort of made a lot of sense when you heard it, but I sort of came a little bit out of the blue. But it was Amazon moving into the Indian market by acquiring the rights to New Zealand's home cricket rights. So, I mean, it's a simple enough rights buy deal, but for obvious reasons, it being in India and it being cricket and it being Amazon, it's a little bit more interesting. The OTT space in India is like pretty fascinating. I mean, it's one of those places where mobile technology has helped the population catch up with other parts of the world where like general internet technology is a bit more advanced. So you've got this kind of like, it's bridged this kind of big chasm where a lot of people are able to access broadcast, yeah, live sport via their mobiles in a way that they may not have been able to do under like a traditional pay TV model, for example.
Yeah, it's circumvented that broadband infrastructure. I mean, as you say, it is a really interesting market because Disney, which has obviously made its big play in the entertainment space in the last year, they own Star India, which of course holds the most coveted cricket rights in India, the IPL, and India's national team matches, which will be coming back onto the market, I think, sometime in the early mid 2020s, I think it's about 2023 or so that the IPL goes back to tender at least. Possibly Amazon positioning themselves there as a rival to Disney.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to do it, cricket's the way to do it in India. Perhaps it's a perhaps it's an obvious move for Amazon going in with a cricket's rights deal. It's going to have some interest, but it could also just be a bit of a R&D kind of acquisition to have a look at that territory and find out what works and what doesn't, I guess.
Yeah, which would be similar, I guess, to what we've seen with the Premier League here in the UK and with tennis and Autumn Nations Rugby, the project that they're working on at the moment, where they're just getting a sense of each part of just getting a flavour of each part of the ecosystem, and then perhaps lining themselves up for a bigger investment down the line, or perhaps just feeding stuff into this huge kind of data and retail led empire that they have elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing them moving into the sort of next stage of that sports rights acquisition strategy with what they've been doing on in Europe, in Germany and Italy, especially with the Champions League, where they've become more of an established player.
Well, it happens, Tom, that Marie Donoghue, who is the VP of Global Sports Video at Amazon, is going to be talking during the Sports Priority T Summit next week to our boss, Nick Meacham. What are you particularly interested to hear besides what we've been talking about, or perhaps expanding on what we've been talking about? What kind of insights would you hope for into the Amazon universe?
I'd be interested to hear why they've taken the approach that they've taken. So what they were looking for in the initial markets they moved into, what they were looking for from the rights that they originally acquired, but then also how that lines up with the other parts of their business. I mean, I think that's the kind of fascinating thing about Amazon, is like they've got so many different strands now. I mean, that not just what we know, like the online bookseller that they started as, but the web services element, the grocery element, even sort of just the kind of other tech that goes around all of that. And just finding out where it fits into that whole picture, really.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting as well to see how some of the more tech-led elements of just the viewing experience, how that fits into what they're thinking about, you know, some of the things that they're able to do as a kind of a native OTT player, where they can look, you think about their entertainment service, you've got X-Ray, where you can follow up, you can do the thing of, oh, what's that person been in, without having to get your phone out and look at IMDb. There are very obvious kind of stats and data analysis crossovers there for viewers in sport. Mike, is there anything that you'd add to that, or that you're particularly looking forward to from that session?
I'm often bouncing between Netflix and Amazon Prime Video, and just the difference in user experience on the Amazon, you know, between the two companies. Amazon is just so far behind Netflix. You have to get right up close to your TV screen, it seems, sometimes, to be able to, you know, work out what the hell it is you're searching, because the search box, the search function is just so small and things like that. It's just simple things. It beggars belief, really, that a company of the scale and size and resources of Amazon can't seem to get their user experience up to the level of a company like Netflix. But that's just a personal grievance I have with that. In terms of next week, it'd be interesting to know what Marie Donoghue's kind of remit is, where it kind of begins and ends, you know, what kind of role she plays in the kind of rights acquisition strategy, and the general kind of programming lineup. Obviously it's a global role, but how much involvement she has in making those decisions on a market by market level, I think it's going to be very interesting to find out. And I think that will also tie into another session that we have next week on Twitch, and leveraging the Twitch opportunity. I think the session is called, with our good friend Charlie Beale from Seven League moderating that one, features Arsenal, AC Milan and Marseille. Interested to know where Twitch it fits within the broader Amazon ecosystem, how Amazon views Twitch as distinct from Prime Video and everything else they do, as you guys have been saying. And then obviously within the Twitch session itself, just getting a better understanding of how major rights holders distribute content through that platform, how they approach it, what they do differently with it, how they utilize all of the various bells and whistles that platform has. Obviously Charlie Beale has been embedded in Twitch for some time, so he will be very clued up, and I'm sure we'll have a lot to share insights wise in terms of his perspective on it. So yeah, that's just a couple of things I'm looking out for him.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point about the boundaries between different parts of the Amazon operation and what feeds into what, and then who has oversight over a particular decision given the business implications that it might have. But the Twitch one is kind of another thing again, because yeah, we are used to thinking of Amazon as in terms of the way most of us interact with it, which is maybe buying products, maybe watching video and feeling like that's all part of the same ecosystem. And Twitch kind of seems to sit, at least as far as the user's concerned, off to one side, you know, and I don't know whether that's because they bought what was a popular and thriving and youth-oriented service and kind of brought it into this huge corporation, or whether it's because they want to develop it slightly differently or quite how it's going to work. I mean, I do think that they certainly at this point, from what I understand, and you can correct me on this, Mike, is that with a few exceptions, they don't see it as a right player in the same way that Prime Video is, and that what we might learn from this session with Charlie is that they are trying to educate, you know, their work in sport is trying to educate rights holders how to use it, basically, about how viewers and communities behave on Twitch, what value they can get out of it, what kind of content is going to work on there, and what options they have.
Yeah, if I can just interject a little bit. I mean, I think some of the moves that Twitch have made this year have been geared to, and the way I see it being set up is that like Twitch looks like it's trying to position itself as a here and now live offering. So like it launched that Twitch Sports feed and it's brought in probably some of the clubs that are involved in that session, or at least I'd like to hope they are anyway. Prime Video seems to be the video on demand thing that maybe you might call the more adult service, and then Twitch is the youth orientated live here and now service. It is an interesting kind of position between the two, because they do kind of do the same thing. You can watch live sports or live esports or streamers. I mean, you can't watch the streamers on Prime Video, but you can watch live things happening on both.
But I mean, it might be as well that at least initially, while Twitch works out what it is outside of being a service for gaming streams, you know, it's somewhere for people to go and discuss and enjoy something together that's not necessarily a live game, even if the stream is happening live. It might be a little bit more of a sandbox than other things that we're seeing in the broadcast space.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's what it seems to me is. It's more of that social element, isn't it? That community building, the shared viewing experience. Everything that has kind of grown up around esports streaming back to your point, Owen, about that education piece, it's understanding where traditional sports rights holders can fit within that, how they can capitalize on that, reach a new audience, and then kind of engage them on a platform that they exist on and deliver content, whatever form that may take, in the right ways, in the way it's going to get picked up. So yeah, I think, to be honest, I think tune in next week and
yeah, exactly.
We will hopefully learn a bit more about this, because you know, we're obviously guessing at what it might be, but I think it's certainly an area of interest for everyone. So yeah, we'll see.
Tune in next week is a very good bit of advice. What else should we be tuning in for, Mike?
I'm going to selfishly, shamelessly plug one of my own sessions, Owen. I'm moderating two next week, the first of which on day one is looking into underserved sports and how they approach OTT. Underserved is obviously an interesting description for some of these sports, given that certain sports that are perhaps more niche, but they, you know, underserved in the mainstream for sure, but perhaps not elsewhere. And I think one organization that we've got on that, or representative from an organization that we have on that panel, is Joe Carr, who is the CEO of Thrill One Sports and Entertainment. This was an organization that was essentially created in January of this year. They combined Nitro Circus, the action sports kind of traveling touring show created by Travis Pastrana, and merged that with Street League Skateboarding, the kind of leading professional skateboarding series. And then there's a production company within that as well, founded or co-founded by one of the founders of Street League Skateboarding. So they packaged it all up. These are underserved sports in the mainstream, as everyone says, you know, it knows around action sports, but they have a real, you know, strong community. They are, you know, pretty big sports in their own right. I think when they formed Thrill One, it became overnight, it became the largest action sports media company on the planet, with more than 40 million followers across their own social and digital channels. So really interested to hear how they're kind of approaching the OTT environment, how they're engaging fans through Facebook, who are one of the other organizations on this particular panel. We've got Reese Beer, who's the global sports programming lead as well. And Thrill One have just launched their own network as well, which is going to be distributed through Xumo, the OTT service in the US. It's a free kind of ad-supported 24/7 offering. So they'll be putting the whole Nitro Circus and Street League Skateboarding archives through that. But yeah, really interested to hear how they go about first generating awareness of a service like that or a network like that, and then obviously monetizing it and working with their existing partners to kind of, you know, add further value to their deals. Yeah, the third and final guest on that particular panel is Marcel Mahelt, who is the managing director of DTM, who launched DTM Grid, their new free OTT service earlier this year. So again, interested to understand the kind of business model, how that ties into their broader growth strategy. Obviously, it's a motorsport series that is a domestic series within Germany, but is increasingly trying to grow its international profile. So interested to understand how they kind of benchmark themselves against other players in the industry within and outside motorsport. So yeah, lots to discuss on that panel. And I hope you, Owen, and everyone else can join.
Well, let's hope so. Tom, anything else that you'd flag?
Oh, if we're doing shameless plugs, then I'm going to plug my session as well. I'm looking forward to this one. I had a conversation with my guest the other day, and the session title was "Innovative Approaches to Driving the Value of Soccer Rights," and the three speakers I've got are from three. Like what I said, I think reasonably fairly as like challenger leagues in Europe. So I've got Leander Monbaliou from the Belgian Pro League, Nuno Maura from the Portuguese Football Federation, and then Melgozata Borkowska, who's a media rights consultant for the Polish Ekstraklasa. And they've all within the last kind of couple of years all enacted sort of slightly different strategies with what they're doing with their broadcast rights and just general content. So, I mean, the Ekstraklasa went down a OTT route. They launched a service which was having put all of their sort of overseas games, made them available for free on Dailymotion, and discovered that wasn't really such a great idea. They decided to launch their own OTT service, I think it was last year. And the Portuguese Football Federation decided it wanted to get more content out there and created its own linear network, which is Canal 11. And then earlier this year, the Pro League did a big deal with 11 Sports to put all of their games on the same broadcast platform for the first time, which they hadn't done previously. It had been split amongst the variety of telecommunications firms in Belgium. So, I'm interested to hear more from them, what they think the merits are of each of the different routes they've gone down, but how also as kind of smaller properties they had to fight for attention in their marketplaces and in the sort of overseas marketplaces too. Because I think that, like, whilst it's probably easier for the likes of the Premier League and La Liga to gain attention overseas, these guys have got to be a bit more innovative in how they approach that.
Yeah, and I think in you know, thinking about both of those panels really, but it may well be the case that we see a lot more divergence in terms of how rights strategies develop over the next few years below that top level. I mean, at the top level, you're possibly still going to see rights fees going up and rights income going up for leagues and competitions. But the number of platforms that they want to be on also grows. But for those lower down, maybe the traditional sources of income might not be as plentiful as as they once were. Perhaps they have to go a different way that works for them and their audience.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing as well that I should probably point out is that Nuno Moura, who's from the Portuguese Book Federation, has recently done a master's in OTT broadcast. So this guy's probably top of the game when it comes to what is and the do's and don'ts of what to do in that space. I think there's just from my conversations with him the other day, there'll be a lot kicking around in that session, I think.
Right. Well, there'll be a lot kicking around for both days, I think. There's so much to look out for. I've just been having a scan through the speaker list, and all the heavy hitters are there. There's also an opportunity to take part in some virtual networking and check out some virtual exhibitions as well. It's all happening on the 2nd and 3rd of December. Quick shout as well to all the nominees looking out for the Sports Pro OTT Awards results on the 1st of December. But if you want to join us for the summit itself, sportspro-ott.com is the place to go to register. Reminder to, as we were saying at the top of the program, the Sports Pro OTT newsletter, new and improved. You can register for that at sportspromedia.com. We are going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be hearing from Lee Price, Head of PR and Mischief at Paddy Power, just after this.
Get the very best of Sports Pro sent straight to your inbox. Head to sportspromedia.com and sign up for the Sports Pro Daily. You'll get a roundup of all the biggest stories, features and opinion from our team every single morning. You'll find that all and much more at sportspromedia.com. Sports Pro, connecting and inspiring the business world of sport.
Welcome back to the Sports Pro podcast. As mentioned in part one, last week we held our final Sports Pro Insider Series event of 2020 with a focus on sponsorship. Got to say first up, we have been just absolutely thrilled by the level of interest in and engagement with the Insider Series over the past few months. It's obviously a project that got kicked into gear because, well, we only had so many options to reach you this year. But it's been great to see how well it's taken off and to get so many fascinating perspectives from people right across the industry. The Insider Series will be back in 2021 with a run of monthly events delving into some progressive ideas and hopefully giving us all some sense of where the business of sport is going next. To register for access, including every session we've done to date on demand, get over to sportsproinsiderseries.com. It's all free and there is some truly fantastic stuff in there. Today, as I said, we have a bit of the session I did last week with Lee Price, who's the head of PR and Mischief at Paddy Power. And he talked about the bookmaker's unique approach to sponsorship and messaging. Obviously, not many brands who have a head of mischief. And while not everything they do is to everyone's tastes, it's absolutely recognizable and distinctive. Lee kicked things off with a presentation about Paddy Power's shirt deal last year with English soccer club Huddersfield Town. You might remember this one. They launched with big sash logo across the front of the jersey, and then revealed that the real shirt wouldn't be carrying their branding at all. Neat little wheeze, good way for Paddy Power to make an impact in a very betting-heavy part of the UK sports sponsorship market and tell a different story. But it was also the result of some diligent preparation and some disciplined execution. They stuck to a 7-day plan, which owed a little, not quite everything, to Craig David. And in the end, Paddy Power were very happy with the results. That's the context. Podcasts, obviously, not much of a visual medium. So we're going to skip ahead through the presentation to the Q&A section, which included some questions from me and from our audience. If you want to take a look at that opening section, it's all on the site, unsurprisingly, given the pitch you heard from me just a moment or two ago. For now, though, we'll hear what Lee had to say about sponsorship, about campaigning and the Paddy Power difference. Let's take a listen.
You're listening to the Sports Pro podcast.
I did want to ask, just in reference to that campaign and you know the plan that you had for it, what was the research that had gone into that map, into that kind of that playbook that you had for that launch week? Because, you know, Paddy Power hadn't done that kind of sponsorship before, certainly not shirt sponsorship.
How were you able to be as confident as you were about the course of events as far as the press reaction was going to go?
Oh, I mean, it's easy to be confident now after the event, isn't it? I think at the time we maybe had three versions of a plan. So we had, you know, for the three kits, yeah, plan A, B and C. But I think we really bought into the insight, and to be honest, launching this sort of campaign around this sort of topic as a bookmaker is pretty scary. But the thing that was never in doubt was the fan insight and the genuine nature that this sort of stuff does annoy fans. So that felt rock solid to us. Finding our role and finding our way of bringing it to attention, generating talkability, of course, you can never guarantee that. But we just believed that it would work. And the kicker for us was that friendly match. We felt that if we just released the kit with the sash, that would get talkability. But we did analyze it and we felt that it would be seen through pretty quickly and the story would be gone within a couple of hours. So when we realized that Huddersfield were due to play a fixture that week, we all just looked at each other in the Eureka moment and went, this is the thing that's going to really launch this campaign. It's having a kicker. And it's not something we've done before, I don't think, in that sense. But when we realized the opportunity, we knew we had to do it. And now whenever we talk about current marketing stuff, we often say, what's the kicker? What's the friendly match? What is that level up? And so, yeah, we were confident, but we did have backup plans just in case, which extended into a second week.
And what kind of analysis were you doing through the week? Was it a feel thing? I mean, you talked about, you know, sometimes it's more about instincts than it is about data with some of the stuff that you do. When you talk about the reaction to that friendly match, were you reading into social media data? Were you reading into, were you doing your kind of due diligence when it came to into kind of media figures, or did you just feel like, okay, let's sit tight now and let's go with plan A?
A bit of both is the truth. I think at each key milestone of the plan, we trended, and we don't always trend, particularly in the UK. So that's already an unusual start and an indicator that it's being talked about a lot. You obviously measure the amount of tweets and comments you're receiving at the Paddy Power account and the sentiment of those. I think what was really reassuring actually was just the straight launch on the Monday, just the We Are Sponsoring Huddersfield launch, which we thought would go under the radar. But immediately it started the conversation, which we thought we might have to work a bit harder to get going. You know, talking about, do we need to get influencers to start saying these hypothetical questions around the issue? We didn't, because fans straight away started talking about it. So that was really reassuring. And then on the Wednesday, the moment that shirt, the image of that shirt dropped from Huddersfield, again, we felt it was important that they published it. The reaction was immediate and so fast that you couldn't miss it. So you didn't really have to analyze it too carefully, which is a bit of a lame answer, sorry. But it was so in your face, you couldn't, a bit like the logo really, but it was so in your face that you couldn't avoid the feeling of, this is getting a reaction. We don't need to push this too hard. And then that's why Thursday sitting tight was really important, but also quite tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to take it back a step, I mean, you showed us that slide of clubs, particularly in the EFL, where betting logos are fairly prevalent. You know, what process did you come to that decision where you thought, well, this is something we can meet head on by buying a shirt sponsorship and then not using it, rather than maybe some other tactics you might have had at your disposal to cut through some of that noise?
I guess the brutal truth is, if we just sponsored a shirt, the value would be limited to X. Whereas we felt using the sponsorship in this way, although we weren't literally using it, gave us a magnifier for that value. And we felt that there's very little value in Paddy Power getting involved in shirt sponsorship just in the normal way. Very, very little value for us, because it'd just be another bookmaker amongst a sea of bookies. So this was almost the only way that sponsoring a team would work for us.
Okay, we've got a lot of questions coming in already. I want to stick with those that are related to the campaign. And first of all, we've got one from Harry Tierney, who asks, how were Paddy Power able to convince Umbro to go along with this campaign? Was that something that came into the equation when you were plotting this out?
It was, and the truth is that they weren't immediately delighted, as you might expect, because the sash image was so horrific. But they understood that the end result was an amazing kit where actually the only logo on there, other than Huddersfield's, was theirs. So I guess they had to weigh that up internally and say, okay, there's going to be some initial backlash and we might get dragged into that. But and I think that must have been their initial concern. But we were quite clear of them that when this image drops, no one's going to be talking about Umbro. They're going to be talking about Paddy Power and be angry at us. I think that's the journey we had to take them on. And then it was just a gamble of their own, I suppose. But for the whole season, Huddersfield wore this lovely kit with just Umbro on it.
Mm, I suppose it's an extension as well of whenever a club does a questionable sponsorship deal, the kit sponsor is already locked in, so they only have so much influence on that. Andrew Selby asked, and this is an extension really, how was Huddersfield's initial response in doing something so different and risky?
This was really important. I think we met with four clubs initially to be the Huddersfield role. One club I can't name, but basically had a half agreed a sponsorship deal, so we weren't really that into it. Huddersfield we met and immediately got it and started coming up with their own suggestions, some good, some less good, but you know, were clearly bought into it. Another club were quite keen, and then a fourth club were quite immediately pushing back and, oh, I'm not sure you could do that, I'm not sure you could do that. And I think with this sort of plan and us knowing the risks along the way, we had to have a partner here who was fully in it for the journey. And that was tested by Huddersfield. You know, when the FA's absolutely haranguing you and making all sorts of threats, I'm sure, it can't have been easy for them. But because we'd agreed this plan and because from the outset we were really clear with Huddersfield, this is what we want to do, this is how it's going to go, we thought they bought into it, and that's why we chose Huddersfield to work with for the initial partner on this.
Mm. How much did you have to work alongside them through that week with their comms teams and their you know, sponsorship account managers, all the rest of it? I'm guessing you kind of had to keep quite a tight seal on things.
Yeah, there was, I think on the Thursday where we were keeping a low profile, a club employee was on Twitter and they weren't doing anything wrong, but they were sort of doing winky smiley faces in reply to certain comments. We had to say, mate, can you just come off Twitter for today, please? Because if you ruin it, that's going to be really lame. But there was a really open dialogue. And the fact that on the night of the game, when they were ringing us saying, we're not sure about wearing this kit, but they were prepared to have a conversation about it rather than just saying, we're not wearing the kit, I think it's testament to them and their bravery and their understanding of what we were doing.
Mm. Jem Maidman asks quite an interesting question here. Fair play, great idea. Surprised so many people fell for it, though. Well, we're all wise after the event, Jem. but how do you, how do you think this damages Huddersfield and Motherwell long term? I mean, they can't exactly have a front of shirt betting sponsor again, can they? I mean, is that, like, that might not even be your department, but is that something that you factor into a campaign like this, that, you know, what's the value now of that front of shirt space for whoever follows Paddy Power whenever that happens?
Yeah, I think that is a consideration. It's a fair question. It's a consideration the clubs will have had. But I believe this season, Motherwell have got a new sponsor and they're fine with that. Huddersfield have chosen not to have a sponsor because they like to be unsponsored and have done something different with their sponsorship package. But I don't think it damages either team. And in fact, both shirts sold huge numbers compared to previous years. I can't remember the exact numbers, either fourth or fifth, but Huddersfield was in the top five football shirts sold in the UK for last season, which is extraordinary given they've just been relegated from the Premier League. So I know that's a one season thing and there is a legacy of would other bookies work with them in the future. I honestly think the answer is they would. I think certain overseas bookmakers would sponsor them because their target audience isn't the one that knows about the Paddy Power thing. Their target audience is an overseas market. And if they get back into the Premier League, I can guarantee they'd be offered a bookmaker sponsorship.
I suppose it's an interesting step change for Paddy Power as well, in that, you know, we are seeing a lot of conversations around the volume of betting messaging, particularly in the EFL. And on the one hand, it's a lifeline financially for a lot of these clubs, particularly at the moment where grounds are closed. But it is also something that has been an ongoing conversation with the authorities, with other groups. I mean, was this a part of it as well? The fact that maybe it was becoming time for betting companies in the UK to start thinking about, you know, some of the sensitivity of their messaging, to start thinking more constructively about public health. You know, if I think back to 2018, say, almost all betting messaging seemed to be very call to action heavy and, you know, bet now and here are the latest odds, etc. And if you stop and watch a Premier League, if you, you know, if you're halftime of a Premier League game this season, there's a lot more public awareness campaigns around problem gambling and so on. How much was this campaign constructed with that in mind, the fact that you are going to have to pivot to a different way of communicating with an audience?
Well, I think, to be honest, Paddy Power wouldn't have had to pivot, because our approach has been far less call to action, the way you say, than most other bookies. But yes, we recognise that the industry would probably have to pivot, and that we were best positioned to make that call, because our advertising has been brand-led and humour-led. Last summer, this idea came on the back of the whistle-to-whistle ban for gambling ads, so no adverts between certain breaks and whatnot. So I think that had to be a factor. It wasn't the key driver. The key driver, truthfully, was the fan insight and doing something brave and ambitious. But I guess part of it would have been that for Paddy Power, advertising in a different way would actually just be doing what we were already doing.
Mm. Right, let's take a step back from this campaign and look at the Paddy Power approach more generally. Obviously, some of what you do is sponsorship. A lot of what you do is communication around sports events. But we'll start with your job title, Lee, which is head of PR and mischief. What does that mean? What's in your job description that delineates the PR from the mischief, and what brings it together?
It's a good question. I'm not sure 100% know. So the PR is the day-to-day stuff. Mischief is a phrase used by Paddy Power to describe the sort of inherent brand DNA. That isn't too much BS, but it's the spirit of Paddy Power is mischief. When they were formed in 1988, they were formed by three Irish bookmakers trying to see off an invasion of British bookies coming to Ireland because the tax rates had been relaxed. So they felt their best chance of surviving was creating a classically Irish brand. So green logo, Paddy Power is the name, and the Irish crack running throughout everything they do. So it runs through the whole business. But what mischief means in my sense is basically, I guess, activations and campaigns. I say to my friends, I'm a professional attention seeker. I think that's quite a neat description of what mischief means for me.
Yeah. We've got a question from Alex Howard, who asks, how do you go about repeating this, or do you have a big book of ideas? So what, where do some of these campaign concepts come from?
Everywhere and anywhere. I try and keep a real open door policy for ideas, because anyone can have that initial nugget. I don't think, although they end up being these big flashy campaigns, it's not an elaborate idea at the heart of it. It's always quite a simple thought of, wouldn't it be good if, or wouldn't it be funny if. So we did a campaign earlier this year reacting to Hector Bellerin's trees campaign, and he said every time they won, he donates to trees. We said every time they don't win, we'll donate, because, you know, Arsenal are going to Arsenal. And that came from a guy in our customer service team. So we do work with lots of agencies, we work with freelancers, and we just, the whole spirit of our marketing team is idea focused. So a lot of them will be internally, but we do collaborate a lot with agencies and whatnot.
And then from
I haven't got a big book of ideas, because that makes my life very easy. And our nature is usually quite reactive, so they have to come quite quickly, these ideas.
Yeah. And then what's the relationship between something that you're able to do on the PR side and something that might involve a buy? So, you know, the Huddersfield sponsorship is an obvious example. It could involve a media buy, it could involve a donation, as with the campaign you just talked about there. What's the architecture of the company on that side of things, on the marketing side?
It's quite fluid, but I guess I sit alongside the media buying department, and we both report to the marketing director. So the idea is, from the PR team, we pitch it upwards, it gets signed off, and then we all work on it. So there'll often be overlap with the buying department or the social media team, etc. And that's just kind of the way we work. It's very fluid. I don't think you can be too sensitive about silos or whatever, because, you know, mischief, like I said, is supposed to run throughout Paddy Power. So the social media team are forever being mischievous. And I can't get arsy about that. It's just their job. So we are quite fluid in that sense.
Question here from James Hayes. How do Paddy Power manage that line between being funny and too offensive? What processes or internal discussions take place before a launch, activation, stunt, etc.?
Yeah, it's a line that is really hard to define. I'm sure we haven't always got that right. I do think the brand over the last 5 years has come on quite a lot, developed quite a lot, and raised the bar in terms of humour and intelligence to the humour. If you look back at some of the stuff from 5 or 6 years ago, you think, oh, you'd never do that now. But I guess that work is of its time. We talk a lot about, you know, what are the risks here? We always try and say, what's the best case scenario, but what's the worst case scenario, and what's our expectations? We don't want to offend people. We want to generate talkability. Sometimes people get offended along the way, and that's okay if the target's the right target. But we try and punch up, and we try and make sure that our insight, our the territory we're operating in, is pretty bulletproof, and that it's either funny or it's bang on the money. We don't really want to be being negative or targeting individuals as such, although I'm sure there are lots of exceptions out there which can contradict me straight away.
I mean, would you err on the side of putting something out if you think it's going to be provocative, or would you now tend to be a little bit more considered in what the repercussions of something could be before you go public with it?
It really depends on the idea. Like, I don't think we'd shy away from being provocative if we felt it was for the right reasons. So with this campaign, we felt it was provocative, but for all the right reasons. If we felt it was provocative in a more potentially damaging way, we would shy away from it, or we would consider it more carefully. Again, there's stuff in the past that's been provocative for the sake of being provocative, maybe, arguably, 6 or 7 years ago, whereas now that isn't the intention.
Mm. Do you, it's interesting because it sounds like some of the conversations you have are not dissimilar from the ones that a comedian or somebody putting something out into the culture might have before they do that. I mean, do you correspond with anyone, consult with anyone in that kind of a world, or do you just kind of have to rely on your own instincts?
We generally rely on our own instincts, although for example, at the 2018 World Cup, we did a thing around LGBTQ plus rights in Russia, because everyone else talked about Novichok and whatever else. And we consulted with a partner from that industry, so with the Attitude Foundation, who are experts in LGBTQ plus issues. And, you know, we ran copy lines by them, we ran the idea by them as a sense check, because I think that's just good practice. But generally, it comes down to our own instincts. So last week, England played Ireland at Wembley, and we had an ad basically saying heat map for Jack Grealish, Declan Rice, and the heat was a shape of snake. And we talked a lot about that, even though it's quite a low-level activation, because we wanted to make sure it wasn't unfair or it wasn't too targeted at individuals. And the reason we felt that was okay was because that topic is well-established, of them turning down Ireland to go to England. It wasn't new, and people weren't absolutely hammering them over it. And crucially, the game was a meaningless friendly, so we felt it was a safer territory. Whereas when Jordan Pickford injured Virgil van Dijk earlier this season, the backlash he got was so extreme. He was getting death threats, he had to hire security, and we felt that it wouldn't be fair for us to weigh in on that one, and that those two scenarios are quite markedly different. But that line is still quite fine, even in those examples.
Mm. Jack Lofthouse asks a slightly more practical, tangible take on this. How much legal advice goes into Paddy Power's campaigns?
We have a legal department, which maybe that says it all, but I mean, I always consult the lawyers because I want their ask to be on the line rather than my own, and because they're a lot smarter than me. But yeah, we do take legal advice, and our internal legal team, they will rarely say you can't do this full stop, but they will say the risks of doing this are X, Y, and Z, and generally that list gets too scary. We go, oh, maybe we can't do this.
This is the Sports Pro Podcast.
Just on a broader sense, I mean, whenever you adopt a tone of voice that's outside the ordinary, there's always going to be people who love it and people who love it slightly less. And, you know, Paddy Power's messaging has a bit of a Marmite quality for some people. How do you balance that? Obviously, you want to attract customers through sponsorship and marketing. But when you're aware that certain people are going to be switched off the brand, what's your approach to that?
Yeah, I think you have to just accept that if you are going to be this kind of brand, that you have to embrace it, and that some people are going to hate your brand, and that's okay. And that, I guess, the gamble initially in 1988, and which continues now, is that enough people will really love your brand to justify you not appealing to people who really hate you. And it's better to do it that way around rather than just be a beige brand that is interchangeable with all the other betting companies. I know that's quite a simplistic answer, but I think that's it. I think we stand out. You'll remember us, love us or hate us. If you're asked to name a bookie in the UK, we'll probably be in your top three. And that's, I guess that's all you need to do.
Yeah. John Ganshaw asks a question following on from that, which is, how do you track conversions new Paddy Power users acquired related specifically to this sponsorship? I think he's referring back to the Huddersfield Town campaign. But what kind of record keeping do you have for the effectiveness of some of your campaigns?
It's the truth is, it's really hard because traditionally PR used to be measured in AVE, which is better described as BS, so we don't do that. And it's always hard to specifically directly link this big marketing campaign with the nitty-gritty numbers. What you will see is a quarter-on-quarter analysis of awareness, consideration, etc., and how they've changed. And every year you will see, because we compare the last 3 years of quarter one, two, three, four, and those metrics. When there's a spike, you say, oh, why did that spike there? And admittedly, that spike is a couple of percent, to be clear. But when you do see a spike, generally, well, that's when that activity happened. And I guess the reverse, if it goes down, you say, what happened there? Either our activity didn't work or someone else's really did. So it's hard to literally say this campaign got us X number of customers or it generated Y in revenue. But you can see that the timeline of this campaign is mirrored by an increase in various key metrics.
Mm. And so, I mean, bookmaking is it's a numbers business, and you have a lot of mathematically literate people, or numerate people, to use the actual term that exists for that quality. You have a lot of numerate people working in it who will, you know, they'll be very, very target driven, very data driven. So what your work, where does that sit in terms internally within the culture of the company when it comes to acquiring customers and it comes to driving financial returns?
Yeah, what you're politely saying is, how do I get away with it? And the answer is, I don't know. No, I think it's not like Paddy Power started doing this 2 years ago, right? And said, right, we're going to do this now, guys, and this is going to work. It's what Paddy Power's always tried to do. So for that reason, it's kind of given a bit of leeway and it's understood that it's part of the brand. I think if another brand decided to start doing something like this, it might be a difficult one to put into numbers. Because there are ways you can, like I just mentioned, but in terms of the literal transactional value, it can be difficult to measure. And I'm sure for those numerate people, it is a challenge, but I just leave them to it.
Mm. How much correspondence is there between those different departments?
there is, like, we do a lot of planning, which I thought might surprise people. We do analyze stuff and learn from stuff, but it's hard to put numbers against a campaign like Save Our Shirt. We know what we spent, we know what the numbers were in terms of social media. That's very easy to measure. We know what coverage we got, and we know all the customer metrics in terms of awareness, etc., and spikes in betting activity. But in terms of directly attributable data, it's tricky, and that doesn't just apply to this campaign. I think it applies to marketing quite broadly, actually.
Mm. Yeah, I think it does. One of the kind of pillars of your sponsorship and marketing strategy, I mean, you haven't done that much conventional sponsorship, although you have put your name to a few events in horse racing. For example, one of the people opening up in the chat, Martin Terza, said, you know, it's strange to hear your voice not on the Totally Football podcast. So obviously there's some sponsorship going on around fan culture that you do. Where are you choosing to apply resources in this space?
It's a good question, because as you might expect, we often contradict ourselves because we're greedy and we're picky. So we want the noisiest stuff, but we also want the most creative stuff. So we do sponsor the Totally Football Show, initially probably because it was the biggest football podcast on the market in the UK and Ireland, and that's enough of a reason to sponsor it. But as that partnership's developed, the flexibility in the slot, for instance, has improved, and they want to do fun stuff. They want to do less call to action stuff. So do we. So that feels like a great tactical buy, but also a great opportunity to highlight the brand. You mentioned horse racing, which is a kind of a different territory for us, because It's quite a traditional sport, and we do try and reinvent stuff there, but sometimes sticking your name on it works, which is not my favourite approach in terms of the football stuff, but for racing, it does work. We sponsored the Champions League of Darts for 3 years. This year would have been the third year. And that was, in terms of the name, it was the Paddy Power Champions League of Darts. But what that opportunity allowed us to do was to create a fan experience around the event. So rather than just go into this hall and plaster it with green logos everywhere, we actually built like a pop-up marquee next to it with loads of experiential stuff for punters on the ground to do. Mainly because we thought it would be entertaining to do that and quite fun for us to enjoy anyway. But we do try and sponsor stuff we can have fun with and add value to, which I know sounds a bit jarring from a bookie, but we want to add value to our sponsorships rather than simply stick a logo on it and run.
Mm. I mean, one of the conversations that we hear a lot of at Sports Pro, where, you know, we talk about OTT quite a lot and digital broadcasting and the opportunity for gamification there and for betting companies to get involved there. How much of a role is that kind of activity going to play in what Paddy Power does over the next few years? How does that affect what you're doing on the messaging side and on the branding side?
The honest answer is I'm not sure yet what role it has for us. I'm sure as traditional opportunities diminish or change, I'm sure that the digital routes will be very interesting for us and we are exploring. But I think everything that we do has to be true of Paddy Power, and we have to find ways to stand out in the way that we've always done. So we'll always look to reinvent the opportunity, but that doesn't mean we won't do some functional advertising or functional marketing here and there where it makes sense to. And hopefully Mischief is here for a long time to come, otherwise I don't know what I'll do.
Well, Mischief might be, we're not here for that much longer, so I'm going to make sure that I answer a few more questions from our viewers. Jack Lofthouse asked, quick one, who paid the fine for Huddersfield Town?
I think we did. That was the agreement. I think they had to literally do it themselves for whatever the legal reasons. I think they had to pay the FA. Mm. That was part of the plan. We knew that there was a risk of a fine.
Miguel Ramos asks, what was the campaign that had the most impact and why? He says he still remembers the one with Jose Mourinho. What's your favourite campaign that you've done, or the most pertinent one that you've done?
I'm glad he still remembers the Jose ad, because that's actually still on TV. So if he had forgotten it, that'd be pretty damaging for us. I think the one that made me sit up in my chair bolt upright, unlike I am now, was probably the Rodri Giggs TV ad. And that wasn't mine. That wasn't my team. That was, you know, a marketing campaign more broadly. But as soon as I heard the idea, it made me nervous and excited. And when I saw the execution, it was bang on the money. And we kept having to change the advert because an unnamed individual kept complaining about certain parts. So that was interesting too. But I think that is one that people will talk about for years to come. And that's a pretty good metric of success, I would say.
Mm. And a related one here from Tim Blower, who asks, do you ever take inspiration from other industry marketing activations? And can you pinpoint one campaign, gambling related or not, that stands out to you?
Oh, loads. I read all the marketing websites and whatnot, hoping that one day I'll see an idea that I can rip off Paddy Power, but I haven't quite yet. But even today, PlayStation have changed the London Underground symbol to all the symbols of their joystick. So the typical symbol is a red circle, which they have on their joystick. So certain underground stations will have a green triangle or a pink square and a blue cross. And what I love about that is it's so simple, so immediate and so easy to get that I would love to have done that bit of work. So we're always looking at other marketing activations, and particularly the clever stuff. I haven't found one that I can copy yet, but any suggestions are very welcomed.
Yeah, well, hopefully more people will be able to see that PlayStation campaign next year. We won't all be quite so confined to our home quarters. James Hayes asks, looking at guerrilla marketing in particular and Paddy Power's tactics, what are the key ingredients to pull off a stunt for brands? I guess that follows on again from the last couple of questions.
I think it's just about meaning it. I speak to a lot of people who work for other brands, various brands, and they say, I really want to do something spiky or provocative or ambitious or guerrilla. But when it comes to it, they don't, and they water it down and end up putting out something that's so clearly not authentic that it doesn't work. I think you just have to mean it. If you're going to do it properly. And I mentioned the thing last week at Wembley with the snake. We did it because we could stand by the joke and that we weren't scared of the joke. You could quite easily overthink that gag and talk yourself out of it, or end up watering it down or adding a lame secondary line or whatever. If you're going to do it and you're going to be bold, then be bold, or just don't do it at all.
Christian Fizier asks, do you think EFL clubs could be financially sustainable in the short term if the premise of Save Our Shirt is introduced in the pending gambling regulatory review, with a ban on front of shirt sponsorship introduced?
The important thing to mention is obviously that this happened pre-COVID, and obviously we didn't know COVID was going to happen. So the importance of revenues right now is different to a year ago. And if we had the idea now, would we have done it? I'm not so sure, because the valid point around clubs need all the money they can get, but also EFL clubs need to spend less money on wages in certain instances. So I think they can be financially sustainable. I don't know what the Gambling Act review is going to do, but if it were to remove gambling sponsorship, I'm sure they would survive longer term, but they'd have to ask some tough questions of themselves. I think we saw that in the government last week.
Okay, and finally, I know that we're going to miss a couple of questions here, but you know, Chris is here cracking the whip. Amy Smith asks, if you could choose any sports property to do something innovative with, who would you choose, and what's your favourite sports sponsorship you've seen other than your own?
Blimey, what would I choose? A couple of years ago, I would have said the League Cup, and then Carabao started doing what they did. Some of it good, some of it confusing, but all interesting. So I would have said the Football League Club Cup is a real interesting opportunity. What is my favourite sponsorship? In Scotland, I can't remember the exact name, but one of their cups is called the Tunnocks Caramel Wafer Cup or something hilarious. And I don't know how they've activated that, but that is enough on its own for me to absolutely adore it. So that's my answer to that question, so I can't think of any other examples.
There was a fantastic launch photo with that, with the guys in there. They were dressed for work, let's say, for making some Tunnocks caramel wafers. Anyway, thank you very much, Lee. That was a very enjoyable 45 minutes or so. Thanks to all of you for your many questions, and sorry we couldn't get to all of them, but hopefully we'll find some forum in which to do that in the future.
Help us spread the word about the Sports Pro podcast. Subscribe, like and share our content on social. Join the conversation on Twitter with the hashtag SportsProPod. And if you're enjoying our work, why not leave us a rating and a nice review on your podcast platform of choice? And if you want to get in touch, you can send us an email, podcast@sportspromedia.com. The Sports Pro podcast, we're listening too.
All right, that's it for another Sports Pro podcast. Thanks very much to Lee Price for his time there. Tom, what can we expect from Sports Pro TT Summit across our digital channels?
There should be some pretty strong daily coverage, I imagine. Probably a couple of podcasts, some reaction, some takeaways. It'll all be there, Owen.
It'll all be there. Well, our listeners can look out for that and look forward to it. We will obviously have to look forward to making it all. But until then, thank you very much, Tom Bassam.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, thank you very much to Mike Long.
Cheers, guys.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We will be back again very soon. Bye-bye.
The Sports Pro podcast is published by Sports Pro Media. The producer is Ed Dixon.